My first night back in the cabin was the most terrifying experience of my life. You can hear about it in one of the previous posts, but the next morning, Wednesday, the ranger showed up with his friends, T-Way, a Pueblo medicine man, and his son, Nathan. These people were amazing. They were instantly likable and sympathetic to my situation, and I mentioned them in a tiny update in my last post, but here's what happened. It was the lore and legends. T-Way is an incredible storyteller. He tells me that Pike's Peak and the surrounding area was inhabited by the Ute, the Minotau, the Arapaho, the Pueblo, the Anasazi, and other Native American groups at various times. In the 1860s, when the gold rush was in full swing, many Indians were violently displaced because of mining operations there. They were torn away from their sacred lands, which was catastrophic to their cultures. T-Way stressed that historically, Americans have not understood the significance of land and names to the Native Americans, and this is critical to understanding the supernatural presence of the mountain. The major world religions like Christianity and Hinduism and Islam are universal. They can be practiced anywhere. You can pick up your whole life and move to Kentucky or Scotland or Istanbul, and you'll still be whatever religion you are. Your God still hears your prayers. He still intervenes in your life. But Native Americans practice land-based religions. The land they inhabit is a part of their creation stories. It's not that the land belongs to them, it's that they belong to the land. And both are in symbiotic relationships with one another. History is embedded in the landscape. A person is reminded of specific lessons and wisdom when they see a part of the land. The mouth of the river has a story attached to it. That fallen tree has a story attached to it. A battle was won here. A chief died there. Peace was made between tribes with a feast here. When a native group is forced out of its homeland, the people lose their history. What's worse, they leave behind the places where their dead are buried. Since the dead are bound to that place, the Indians who left no longer have spiritual connections to their ancestors and thus to their gods. Their medicines and magic no longer work. They forget the names of sacred places, as the names in history and wisdom are forgotten, the tribe's spiritual power evaporates. T-Way said that when Pike's Peak was taken, a group of disgruntled Utes descended on the miners and slaughtered a bunch of them. Because of a complex network of alliances and peace treaties, these Utes were punished by another tribe. They dug holes in the ground and slit the Utes' throats. They then buried them upside down in the holes with their legs sticking out of the ground, so that wolves would feast on their calves. That was supposed to be the end of it. But then something else happened. The legend says that these dead Utes arose from the tainted ground one night. Because their flesh had been flayed from their hips down, they looked like walking skeletons. They hobbled into the Arapaho camps and took women and children back up to the mountain. They forced them down into one of the mines, never to leave again. The howls of women and children have been reported on the mountain for over 100 years now. The Utes and Arapaho engaged in blood feuds, sometimes called mourning wars, for years over this. They exchanged curses, executed and skinned and tortured each other. They stained the once sacred earth on Pike's Peak with rivers of blood. I was pretty mortified by the story. I just kind of sat there with the ranger while T-Way and Nathan blessed the cabin. They burned sage and tobacco inside and outside and used crushed herb dust to cover their hands. They made a handprint on every window and drew small symbols in ash at the top of each door inside and outside. They gave me bundled sage, cedar, hawthorn, and told me to burn it if anyone tried to get inside. It drives bad spirits insane. Then they provided me with small pouches filled with herbs and blessed objects to wear around my neck and in my pockets whenever I went outside. Nathan gave me a totem that he wears around his neck and told me to give it to Faye. Then they sang a really incredible chant in their language. It lasted about 15 minutes. I was blown away. I fucking love these guys. And then we went outside. I showed them the dreamcatcher. They told me that they'd never seen anything like it. The dreamcatcher is made with tree branches woven together with hair. And it has old yarn or wool string with glass beads crisscrossing the center of the pattern. It's old. Handmade. T-Way told me not to touch it or move it. If you find an object of power and do not know who made it or what it protects, you should leave it alone. I asked him if it could be evil. He said, maybe. I got them up to speed on everything that's been happening. I said that a lot of my friends, Redditors, but I didn't explain that, expected that Faye at my house in California was a duplicate, and that the real Faye was somewhere in the woods. T-Way and Nathan disagreed with each other on whether that could be possible, but we searched the woods looking for signs of Faye. We found nothing. I told them about the missing ring, and they said exactly what many Redditors have said. If Faye loved the ring, and it was a powerful symbol to her, it could be used by a bad spirit to harm her. They told me to find it at all costs. They also told me that if Faye indeed was still here on the mountain, she was certainly dead. In the moment that we've all been waiting for, T-Way named the creature that was tormenting us. He said his people called it the imposter. Bad spirits inhabit the land everywhere, and sometimes they get the opportunity to use tragedy like the Pike's Peak Massacre to commandeer a human figure and walk the earth, partially mortal. In the case of the imposter, they collect animal and human parts piecemeal, wherever they can, stitch them together. This is why they walk strangely, vocalize strangely, and when they never show their faces or come out during the day, they can't pass for humans, see? I asked T-Way why I always see someone facing away from me at the edge of the forest, and he said it's because it doesn't want me to know its identity. But eventually the imposter will come for me, wearing Faye's skin and teeth and hair, and try to convince me that it was her. And when I asked him what it wanted, he said, nobody knows. He also told me that there is a power in names, and as many people have said, I should not speak its name. Especially not to it, because that could provoke it. Of the voices I was hearing in the forest every night, T-Way said they practice what they hear for decades. It makes it easier for them to hunt. For the really freaky shit, T-Way, Nathan, and the ranger left at sunset, and I spent the rest of the evening thinking about all this, and I think I figured out a lot of things. Around 9 p.m., something disturbing happened. I used the sat phone that the ranger gave me to call Faye. She actually answered, and she was just lying in bed reading. We had a great conversation. I told her I missed her so much and that I was up here trying to solve what was happening. I told her I wanted to have a family with her. She said she was feeling better. They actually gone a whole night without sleepwalking or terrifying Jason and Richard, my buddies who were looking after her while I was in Colorado. And after about 15 minutes of talking, I started hearing sounds outside. I heard footsteps crunching on the dry snow, and I heard a voice. And my voice. It said things like, flight, insomnia, miss you, see you soon. The thing had been standing near the window, mimicking my conversation with Faye. I told Faye I'd call her back later and hung up the phone. Then went silent. Thing walked around the cabin slowly, trying to figure out if I had moved. Kept mumbling and repeating a few phrases as it went. Finally, it came and knocked on the door. Its knocking was gentle, just like last night. I was a little bit less scared because of all the blessings T-Way had put in the cabin, but I still held onto the gun just in case shit went down. He spoke to me in my own voice. And the first thing he said was, the hole will fill with snow and
blood.
So yeah, that amped up my fear quite a bit. Every hair on the back of my neck bristled. Do you know the feeling of being so scared that your vision turns hyper-real? Everything looks like a realistic video game, so everything looks just slightly off. Then it knocked again and said,
hello? May I come in?
I said simply, No. Leave. Then it knocked for another 30 seconds or so. And said,
"What's your name?
Hello?"
I lied and I said, "My name's Daniel. Now leave. You can't come in." The thing started knocking harder. A lot harder. Non-stop. And said,
"What is your name? What is your name?"
It was terrifying to hear my voice coming from the other side of the door, and to hear rage building in that voice. I said again, "My name is Daniel!" But the thing just kept yammering and asking the same question. It was occasionally saying things like,
"Ticket.
Ticket.
Rental car. You go up in the trees. The hole. The hole. Down in the hole.
What
is your name? May I know your name?"
Then I had an idea. I was really good with fake accents. When I was a child, my first language was German. My dad immigrated to Boston and met my mom. I started speaking in a thick accent, talking about my day, and then started shouting in German. I recited a poem I knew. My visitor went silent and stopped knocking. I could tell it was just listening, so then I started shouting in a British accent and reciting lines from V for Vendetta, which is one of my favorite films, and I shouted thank you in every single language I know. I once committed to hearing it in 100 languages and stopped around somewhere in the 20s, but my unwanted guest just sort of stammered a bit, trying to mimic me but failed to do so. I was no longer speaking in any recognizable pattern or tone. Eventually, it just started growling, the sounds Faye and I heard in the forest when we first stayed at the cabin.
What you, oh my.
And it began scratching and pounding on the door. I grabbed the sage bundle and torched it with my lighter and waved it around the door frame. I didn't know if the thing outside could smell it, but it walked off the porch, all pissed off, growling, and went off into the night. This time I ran to the window and tried to catch a glimpse of it, but all I could see was a very dark, amorphous form disappearing into the trees. I think I figured out a lot of stuff. I think this entity is mimicking me because it's going to try to convince Faye that it's me. It's rehearsing my voice and then whispering to Faye while she's sleeping, talking to her in her dreams, trying to get her to let it inside of our house. I think it wants to convince her that I am the imposter and not it. I think I also figured out why the voices go crazy at night and why they're getting closer to my home. These fuckers aren't trying to scare me. They're trying to deprive me of sleep. If I'm psychologically and emotionally drained, I'm weaker. If I'm delirious, I'll make a mistake. Their or his attempts to get at me will be easier. I'm still trying to figure out how controlling Faye like a puppet in her sleep plays into all this. I know what I saw. There was a man standing outside our home, walking the exact same creepy way that Faye was sleepwalking at the exact same time. I'm also considering the possibility that I also made a terrible mistake and that the imposter has already won. See, when I went outside for the first night at the cabin with Faye, trying to see where the voices were coming from, I left the door unlocked. That's the moment when Faye was replaced with something else. I don't know what to think, but for now, I'm going the fuck to sleep.